This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Fertility rates have fallen nationwide. What are the factors behind this? Is it tied to women having more freedom to choose when to have a family? Does economic insecurity play a part? Later, we'll speak to a Harvard researcher about the relationship between a woman's education level and childbearing. Now, earlier this year, Where We Live spoke with the Pew Research Center about its report, which found 15% of American women in their mid-40s were childless, the lowest point in 20 years. The long-term trend was in part due to delays in childbearing related to increasing educational attainment and women's labor force participation. Today, Where We Live, we wanted to now focus on the stories of Connecticut women who want children but are delaying having them. Just ahead, an OBGYN will join us to talk about how she counsels women who've decided to postpone pregnancy for a number of reasons. Are you one of them? We want to hear from you. First, how does corporate America view pregnant women and mothers? According to a New York Times investigation, pregnancy discrimination has increased among some of America's biggest companies. Have you experienced pregnancy discrimination where you work? You can email us, wherewelive@wmpr.org, and as always, find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Now, joining us for more on the New York Times investigation is the newspaper's economy reporter, Natalie Kitroweff. She's joining us by phone today. Natalie, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I wanted to find out, why did you look into pregnancy discrimination? What were you hearing from readers, or I'm just curious about the beginning of this series that you did.
Sure. So my co-writer and I were hearing stories of pregnancy discrimination on our own beats. At the same time, there was this explosion in Me Too coverage. And we saw these examples of pregnancy discrimination as a potential source of an obstacle that was pervasive, as if not more pervasive, as sexual harassment. And that's when we came across Otisha Woolbright, a Walmart worker who had asked for light duty. And her story convinced us that this was something we had to pursue.
When you came across Otisha, I'm curious about the lawsuits that you've also reviewed. I mean, how many are we talking about? How widespread is this?
So there were a little over 3,100 complaints with the EEOC last year, which is, you know, that's hovering near an all-time high. This is despite, you know, obviously corporate America has rolled out cushy sort of maternity leave policies. There's been an effort to try to be more welcoming to mothers and to try to retain them. But we've seen that the incidence of pregnancy discrimination seems to have gone up. We looked at class action lawsuits that, covered, we're talking tens of thousands of women here. So it's pretty widespread. And we also, after the story published, we heard from just hundreds of readers. It was an outpouring of responses from women who had experienced something along these lines.
Now, you mentioned Otisha Woolbright. So this was a woman that was employed by Walmart. Your investigation also looked at stories of women working in white-collar jobs. Tell us about how this discrimination manifests itself, depending on the type of job or a workplace that a woman was an employee of.
Right. So if you're in a low-wage job that requires physical labor, and this can also be blue-collar jobs, you know, jobs that pay a little bit more, the way that pregnancy discrimination plays out can be blatant. It can be someone asking for an accommodation from heavy lifting. You know, they want lighter duty, or they want to transfer away from chemicals that they're working, or they want more rest breaks, or they want to be able to carry water around the workplace. And an employer will deny that request, and not just deny that request, but then, you know, retaliate against the worker for asking for it, sometimes fire them, cut their hours, cut their pay. So that's a really kind of blatant form of discrimination. In office towers, in white-collar jobs, what you're seeing is often much more subtle, and it can be hard to put your finger on. These are sort of women who, as soon as they start to show, as soon as they announce a pregnancy, or even, you know, when they come back from maternity leave, they're finding themselves sidelined, pushed away from prestigious assignments, not invited to client meetings, you know, or setting up the table at a meeting that they used to lead. These kinds of consequences, again, you know, they pile up. And when you look at the patterns that we observed at some of these workplaces, they seem to add up to discrimination.
When we look at pregnancy discrimination in these different companies, Natalie, the people that are the managers, are the supervisors, is it mostly men? Is it also women that are discriminating against pregnant staff?
It's both men and women. We were not surprised, but we noted that women managers seemed to be just as likely as men to do this kind of thing.
This is Where We Live. On the phone with me, Natalie Kitroweff, economy reporter for The New York Times. She and Jessica Silver Greenberg investigated pregnancy discrimination for The Times. If this is something that you've experienced while on the job, we want to hear from you. Natalie, one of the women you profiled again, Otisha Woolbright, tell us about her story, what she experienced at Walmart.
So Otisha worked at the deli and the bakery in a Walmart in Florida. She lifted heavy trays of chicken every day. She started bleeding one day, went to the doctor. The doctor told her, you need to stop doing this heavy lifting. So she brought a note back in and requested a reprieve. Her manager told her that she had seen Demi Moore do a somersault on national TV when she was nearly full term, and so being pregnant wasn't an excuse for Otisha. Meanwhile, we got Demi Moore to comment for the story. It was a stunt double that did this, these acrobatics on the David Letterman show. But no matter, this response meant that Otisha kept lifting. Eventually, she gets hurt. She asks for maternity leave. She gets fired. She asks about maternity leave, unrelated to her getting hurt. She kept working through her pregnancy, kept lifting. She asks about maternity one day. A couple days later, she's told that Walmart will no longer be needing her services. She's right now among several women who are suing Walmart for alleged pregnancy discrimination.
And we have a clip from Otisha. This is from The New York Times, The Daily. Let's take a listen.
I was so devastated. I was just like thinking, what am I going to do? Because I was, you know, a single parent. I had three kids. I had this baby on the way. Why nobody going to hire a 7-month pregnant woman? Who was going to do that? I did everything that they ever asked me to do. And when they let me go, I was so sad and I was so hurt.
Again, that's Otisha Woolbright, one of the women that Natalie interviewed for her investigation, as well as Jessica Silver Greenberg's investigation of pregnancy discrimination in corporate America. What happened to Otisha? This is, again, a woman you can hear in her voice that this was a job she cared about. And when she felt like maybe she wasn't being treated fairly at that moment in time, she had also had other kids that she had, you know, to support. It's not so easy to find a new job.
It took her a year to find another job, and even then, you know, it was a job that paid less than her Walmart job. And right now, she's, as far as I know, not working. The hours at a van rental company where she was working were just too difficult to keep, and they weren't giving her the kinds of hours that she needed to be able to take care of, you know, as you heard, her children. So she's struggling right now. She's still struggling, and she became very depressed after this happened to her. So she's struggling both financially and emotionally.
What are the federal protections for women who are pregnant and want to keep their jobs, Natalie? And if there are protections, why is this still happening in certain companies?
So the law on the books, the Pregnancy Discrimination Act, says that employers have to accommodate pregnant women to the extent that they accommodate workers who are similar in their ability or their inability to work. That sounds like jargon, but what it essentially says is if you're doing this for other people who are like pregnant women, then you have to accommodate pregnant women. That doesn't solve the problem for many women like Otisha, because employers have argued in court that pregnant women are more like people who get injured off the job. you know, employers don't cause people to be injured off the job, and they don't cause people to be pregnant. So, you know, why should they have to accommodate them? That, you know, is being challenged in court. Obviously, right now, Walmart is being sued. So, you know, the issue here is that the federal law does not provide an affirmative right to protection. It doesn't say you must accommodate women. Now, there are laws in several states, in about 24 states, that are much stronger. But right now, the federal law in the books leaves some room for interpretation, which gets to your question of how this can still happen. Now, to be clear, it is being challenged in court, and that Walmart case is going to be a test of that law.
You mentioned it now falls on states if they want to have stronger protections for pregnant women. Connecticut has a new law was signed into law in 2017 that enhances existing anti-discrimination protections for pregnant employees, provides broad definitions of the terms pregnancy, reasonable accommodations, and undue hardship. Natalie, you also profiled some women, as you mentioned earlier, who work in white-collar jobs and this idea of being sidelined, passed over for promotions. Can you talk a little bit about some of those women that you profiled?
Right. So we looked at several sort of the, you know, white-collar firms in America where this happens or where women say this is happening. One was at Merck, the pharmaceutical giant, and we talked to a woman there, Rachel Mountis, who was a rising star before she got pregnant. She was a saleswoman with a prestigious assignment. She was winning awards. She gets pregnant, and she's informed that as a part of a general downsizing, her job is being eliminated. So she is laid off 3 weeks before she gives birth. We talked to another woman, Erin Murphy, at the commodities trading giant Glencore. Again, Erin was a star. She was a senior employee coordinating the movement of oil for traders there. She also was doing very well, And after she got pregnant, she was belittled on the trading floor. Her manager told her having a kid would definitely plateau her career. When she mentioned potentially getting poached by another company, he said, you're old and having babies, so there's nowhere for you to go. She had to pump breast milk in a supply closet that was cluttered with recycling bins. You know, he made comments about, you know, a woman's brain after pregnancy. This is her boss. She's suing that company, and she's still going to work every day there right now. So it's an awkward situation. But yes, you know, for these women, and again, in these office jobs, I guess it depends on your vantage point about how subtle that stuff is. But they certainly felt as though they had become sort of second-class citizens at both Merck and Glencore after they became pregnant.
Because it's a subtle discrimination, is it harder to prove that that's what these employers are doing to these women?
I think it remains to be seen how it plays out in court. The strength of, for example, what the women have on their side in the Merck case is that And Merck is actually not being sued for pregnancy discrimination. It's for disparities in pay and in promotions. There are a lot of women involved in that case. So patterns are really what we're talking about here. You know, one or two instances it can be hard to marshal that as evidence of discrimination. But you know, in Erin's case, she had many, many, many examples that she's citing in her lawsuit. And so, you know, I'm not a lawyer, and I have no position on either of those cases. But I think that what the women are trying to do is to show that this didn't just happen once or twice.
When we look, we know that there's a wage gap for women in the workplace. But when we look at women who become pregnant or mothers in certain jobs, what do we know about where their pay, where their salary stacks up against a male colleague?
So the research is very clear on this. When a woman has a child, it shaves 4% off of her hourly wages. And every child that a woman has shaves 4% off of her wages. That doesn't happen for a man. When a man has a kid, he gets a pay bump of 6%. So what you're seeing is what researchers, what sociological researchers have termed the motherhood penalty, and what they also term the fatherhood bonus. Mm.
Because they're seen as men are seen as being the breadwinner, so they need the salary bump.
Right. So they've looked at why this happens, and mothers being absent from work, taking time off, that explains some of this, but it doesn't explain all of this. And what researchers have found is that there's this pervasive bias against mothers and against pregnant women. So visibly pregnant women are rated in these studies as less reliable, less dependable, more irrational, and less committed to their jobs. And, you know, so the researchers say that men have a different perception when they engender a different perception when they become fathers. They're now responsible caretakers of families who, as you said, need extra money to be able to care for them. The irony, of course, is that women are more and more becoming the breadwinners in American families. So this perception is outdated. Many of the women that we talked to were the primary earners in their family. So, the perception is all off, and the penalty that results can have, you know, it doesn't just affect a woman, it affects her whole sort of family.
We should tell our listeners, since the New York Times investigation was reported, now New York State has launched an investigation into several companies because of your reporting. Lastly, Natalie, we started the conversation about what prompted you and your colleagues to look at this issue, and it came out of the Me Too movement. Looking at workplace discrimination, we're seeing that there are behaviors and actions that more people are now realizing are not acceptable in the workplace. When you talk with all of these people and hear their stories, what needs to change for corporate America to treat mothers and pregnant women with the same respect as their male colleagues?
So I think the comparison to the Me Too movement is important here. I think with Me Too, what we saw was behaviors that we all sort of deemed the cost of doing business or just necessary hardships that we all go through to be able to kind of work through our days. Small things, you know, things that we might not complain about or mention beyond sort of talking to our friends. Those things turned into things that we decided as a society are kind of unacceptable, that we don't want to live and we don't want to work in a corporate America where that is passable, where that is okay. I think these lawsuits have the potential to change things for the women who work at these companies, and certainly Walmart is the largest employer in the country, and I think, you know, retailers are watching what happens with this case and thinking about their own policies. But I do think that the reason we saw some change with Me Too was that there was this broader cultural shift, and I don't know that you'll see a kind of really sweeping change until there's that kind of recognition about how we are treating pregnant workers in America.
Natalie Kitroeff is economy reporter for the New York Times. She and colleague Jessica Silver Greenberg investigated reporting on pregnancy discrimination. We'll tweet out links to those stories at Where We Live. Natalie, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Up next, are you a Connecticut woman who wants to have children but has delayed starting a family? We want to hear from you. And coming up, we're going to hear from an OBGYN about the types of conversations she's having with women who are postponing having children. That's after the break. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. A recent story from the Connecticut Health Investigative Team reported that Connecticut's fertility rate is 53.4 births per 1,000 women between the ages of 15 to 44. This rate is among the lowest nationwide, according to data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or the CDC. But that stat doesn't tell the whole story. There's actually an increase among Connecticut women over the age of 30 who are actually having more babies. Now, some of the reasons include women have pushed off starting a family due to earning advanced degrees. We're going to talk about more about the correlation between education and childbearing later in the show. But for the women who are opting to wait, what kinds of conversations are they having with their doctors? Are you a woman who wants to have children but have pushed it off? Or on the flip side, did you decide to have children at a young age? And how has that decision affected your life, your career? Later, we're going to talk about the risks women face if they try to conceive after a certain age. I know when I became pregnant with my first child, I was amused to find that at 35, I was advanced maternal age. And at one point, that was called geriatric pregnancy. I'm glad it's not called that anymore. But joining our conversation now in studio is Dr. Amanda Callen, assistant professor of obstetrics and gynecology, specializing in reproductive and endocrinology and infertility at Yale School of Medicine. Dr. Callen, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So when we talk about the general fertility rate, what exactly are we talking about there?
So the general fertility rate is this way to sort of quantify the number of births in a specific population. And so what we're looking at for fertility rate is actually the number of live births per 1,000 women, specifically aged 15 to 44. That's in contrast to this idea of the birth rate, which is the number of births per 1,000 people in the population, but that includes obviously children and men and people who aren't going to be conceiving. So the fertility rate sort of drills down on the number we care about more.
And the general fertility rate annually, looking at the...
Yes, yep, the numbers are calculated annually.
So when we hear that Connecticut is among the lowest in terms of fertility rate, why is that?
So it's a great question, and there's multiple reasons we think that is. I mean, first of all, I think it's helpful to understand that birth rates are declining and fertility rates are declining across the nation. The national average in 2016 was 62 out of every 1,000, and so those numbers are going down nationally. Connecticut is certainly lower than the national average, but it's not unique in New England. Actually, all of the New England states are low, and so we're sort of in this cohort of low birth rate states. The other thing I think is important to note is that the Connecticut's number actually has gone up since 2015. So in 2015 we were 52.5, and in 2016 we're 53.4. So it's stable, although we are low. And I think I'm not an epidemiologist, but you can speculate on multiple reasons for that. There's an increasing average age of first-time mothers. So this idea that you were talking about previously of delaying childbearing and waiting longer to have your first child, there's been speculation that perhaps an aging population in Connecticut maybe have something to do with it. This correlation between median income and demographic factors and delaying childbearing. And this idea, as you said, career and economic factors, so education, wanting to sort of get established in a career or finish out a particular segment of education before having children, and then certainly economic factors as well, I think are all things that I'm seeing from a physician standpoint that people are talking about as reasons why they're waiting.
One of the good things about when we look at the fertility rate here in Connecticut and nationwide is there are fewer teen pregnancies.
Yes. So if you parse out the data and you look at younger versus more advanced reproductive age women, if you look at the 15 to even 24 age category, pregnancy rates have actually gone down. And then if you look at the 35 to 44 age group, pregnancy rates have actually gone up. So we're seeing this really nice decrease in teen pregnancy rates, which is great. And then we're seeing actually an increase in pregnancy rates among women over 35, which again I think reflects this idea of some delay in childbearing and some increasing age at the first birth.
If you're one of those women who've decided to push off becoming pregnant until you've reached a certain point in your career, or maybe you're over 35, we want to hear from you. Maggie is calling in. Maggie, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Hi.
Thanks for your call. Tell us the decisions that you made surrounding starting a family.
Sure. So I'm 30 years old. I've been married for 3 years. And we have decided to put off having children for several more years. And I would say there's really two reasons for that. The first is just the rising cost to raise children the way we'd like to, and that includes providing college education for our children. So I'm a little biased because I am a financial advisor, but I do understand that college tuition is rising on average 3% per year. And so if we're looking at in-state on-campus tuition for UConn, for instance, in 18 years, we're looking at probably around 50,000. So my husband and I are definitely thinking about that as we're starting a family. The second would be, which was already mentioned, is career development. So I'm on track to become partner, and my husband's defending his PhD next month. And if either of us want to be able to take off some time to raise a child, even a few months once the child's born, which obviously a mother at the very least has to do, we want to be in a place in our careers where we're able to do that. And then lastly is just the rising cost of healthcare. So again, I think my profession makes me a little biased because I see this a lot, but you know, an uncomplicated birth, from my understanding in Connecticut, is about $8,000. And if you have a high deductible plan of $10,000 or $15,000, you know, you have to be ready to shell out several thousand dollars before the insurance is going to really cover it. So there are pretty much financial reasons, not to say we're not going to do it. We just want to plan ahead of time.
Well, Maggie, thank you for your call. Again, you can join our conversation, 860-275-7266. Dr. Callen, Maggie laid out very specific reasons about why they waited to have children. Is this what you're hearing from some of your patients?
Absolutely. And that conversation is similar to conversations I'm having every day. So, you know, part of what I do in my field is treat infertility, but also we manage other issues. And in sort of managing those other issues, these conversations come up about childbearing and what's the right time and what's happening to fertility over time. And women are telling me about these absolute same pressures, economic pressures, you know, wanting to understanding the high cost of childbearing, understanding what happens when you have a child, that cost, especially if both parents are working, that cost of daycare.
Yeah, daycare is like another mortgage.
It's so expensive. and so... certainly people are talking about that, you know, again, trying to finish out a career. I know in my own personal experience, that was a part of my own personal decision, was trying to wait until I finished all of my medical schooling. And so I can certainly empathize with those decisions as well. And it's absolutely a large part of the conversation we're having.
Today, we're looking at the choices women are making when they're thinking about starting a family. And we want to hear from you, 860-275-7266. Elena is calling from Mystic. Elena, go ahead.
Hello. I also delayed having a child because of two factors. One, that we wanted to make sure we were financially established. And also, the second reason was that I was getting advanced degrees. And I have to laugh because I had my son at the age of 37, and I was also considered an advanced maternal age.
Welcome to the club.
Yes, thank you very much. Which struck me as absolutely ironic. And, you know, now he's now 9 years old and I'm 46 and I still have, you know, my degrees, which I'm never going to regret getting, but it's been much more difficult to return to the workforce after having a child. That people are not, companies and places are just not as accommodating to mothers as they could be.
Elena, earlier we talked to the New York Times about their investigation in pregnancy discrimination. Is this something that you or other women you know have experienced?
To a degree, I would say yes. I was, I will keep my details limited, but I was in a position to take on a much more advanced position. And when I told my supervisor that I was pregnant, I was fairly much, I was eliminated from consideration for that position.
Well, Elena, thank you for your call. Again, today we're talking about the choices that women are making to postpone. It could be feelings of economic insecurity. Maybe they want to advance a certain point in their career, and they know that a lot comes with having children. And you can join our conversation at 860-275-7266. Dr. Amanda Callen is with us, Assistant Professor of Obstetrics and Gynecology at Yale School of Medicine. What are the risks when women decide, and they have the right to decide along with their partners of when they're going to have children, if they even want to have children. But when you reach that advanced maternal age at 35, or we hear that more women are having babies after 40, what are the risks to conceiving in the first place?
So there's a few different things that we think about in terms of risks in pregnancy, and also the very real risk of not actually being able to conceive as you wait. we know that women are born with all of the eggs that they will ever have. And so that you can almost think of it as a basket of eggs, and that basket mm-hmm. of eggs will dwindle over time. And so by the time a woman reaches menopause, that basket is essentially empty. And so as that basket starts to dwindle, the chance of pregnancy in a particular month decreases to the, in the 20s and 30s, you're talking about fairly high pregnancy rates. And in late 30s, early 40s, pregnancy rates become quite low. The other thing that happens is that the genetic material in each of those eggs is also aging. And so we see that the increase in, birth defects, things like Down syndrome, miscarriage because of, eggs or embryos that have genetic abnormalities increases over time. And so there's a couple of factors that make it more difficult to get pregnant with age. One is that decreasing number of age and decreasing number of eggs. And two is the increased potential for those eggs and embryos to be abnormal. And so those factors really pair together to make it to lead to a decreased pregnancy rate over mm-hmm. time. That rate really starts to drop around 35, and the rate of drop becomes even more accelerated around 37, 38. And we do see women more in our office at those ages who are starting to think about conceiving. There's room for a baby in their lives. But it's more difficult at that point. And now we're starting to have to think about assisted reproductive technologies, ovulation induction, IVF, things like that, that can just be emotionally and financially difficult. So not to be sort of an alarmist, but I think it's important that women who are making decisions to delay childbearing be empowered with that information and understand what's happening to reproductive potential over time. And then they can, we can make our own decisions with that information.
When we're talking about options for women, something that I guess has become trendy in recent years is talking more about freezing mm-hmm. their eggs. I wanted to play this clip because it has crossed over in popular culture, too. This is from the Mindy Project, where character Dr. Mindy Lahiri is actually talking to college-age women about why they should consider freezing their eggs.
When I was your age, I thought that I was going to be married by the time I was 25. But it took a lot longer than that. And unfortunately, your body does not care if you are dating the wrong guy, or the guy you're with is also sleeping with the rest of your dorm. Your body and your eggs just keep getting older, which is why freezing them is actually a pretty smart idea, because it gives you a little bit more time so that you can try to find that one diamond in the crap heap of American men.
Again, that's from the Mindy Project. Dr. Callen, is that something that women in their 20s should consider, or is that still a little too early?
Egg freezing is a technology that has been around for several years at this point, to the point that it several years ago was even no longer considered experimental, because we know that it works well. We know that eggs freeze well and thaw well, and we can get them and we can sort of stash them away. I would say, 20s is probably quite an early time to consider it. Certainly we have women asking about it in their 20s. As I said, we know that generally fertility starts to decline in the mid-30s or so. It is something that I think women should be certainly aware of and consider whether it's right for them.
But it's costly.
It is costly. So egg freezing, can run in the, I'd say $6,000 to $10,000 range to freeze eggs. And it also is a time commitment for several weeks. I can certainly, walk you through the process, but it's injections and medical visits and ultrasounds. The other thing I say about egg freezing is that, for women who choose to freeze their eggs, I don't want it to be considered as sort of a guarantee. So I don't want someone to think, if I freeze my eggs, then I can sort of buy myself an extra 5 years. I think if for women considering freezing their eggs, if I'm seeing a patient in my office and we're talking about egg freezing, I'm going to talk about the pros and talk about the cons and talk about success rates. But at the end of the day, I want a woman or a couple to make their fertility decisions sort of regardless of these frozen eggs, understanding that they are not a guarantee. To proceed on as though the eggs aren't frozen, basically.
Carrie is calling from Hartford. Carrie, go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well.
So I was just going to comment. I'm 38 years old. I had my first child when I was 33. We have foregone having a second child for economic reasons. I have an advanced degree, and I own my own business. And my husband has a job that works strange hours. And so we have found that because we are what most people consider middle class, our only childcare options are expensive childcare options because we don't qualify for any of the free preschool town-run programs. And so we have just decided that because of the expense of childcare and the interest in furthering our careers, it's just not viable to have a second child, despite the fact that we would like to.
Well, thank you, Carrie, for your call. And we have heard that from other listeners as well, thinking about, you know, maybe just having one child. Dr. Cowan, you wanted to comment.
Yeah, and I think that's an important point that your caller is making. The a lot of the popular narrative about delayed childbearing is about, you know, women and these decisions made by women and, you know, career and you know, education. And I've heard the word selfish tossed around. And I think that the important point here is that these are decisions made by women and by couples, by families. These can be career decisions. These can be economic decisions. These can be decisions based on childcare or, you know, based on the you know, a recent layoff or all sorts of considerations that come to mind, and they're not selfish decisions at all. I think they're actually very selfless decisions for women and families to be deciding on the right time, if there is a right time for, you know, a child to be brought into their life.
You can join our conversation. Hester's calling from New Haven. Hester, go ahead.
Yes, hi. How are you?
I'm doing well. What was your experience when you thought about starting a family?
My first child was born at 37. My second was born when I was 41, and I was privileged to have access to good education, to advanced education, and I was one of those girls who would never get pregnant to jeopardize any of that. And in hindsight, that was a very big cosmic joke because it turned out I didn't need to worry about any of that. That was not a concern. And my first child was eked out with IUI, and the second one, we went all the way from IVF to ICSI. And I think two things. The first is, it's nice to extend your career, and I'm all for that. I had a great time. I love that. But the later you go when your fertility drops down, the toll emotionally, physically, psychologically on the couple when fertility process is going down with the, you know, the doctor will can probably expand on this. There are many miscarriages. There's hopes. There's hormonal roller coasters. There's everything going on, and not all couples survive it. Mine did, luckily, but it's a huge toll, and it does affect the whatever family there is. And the other thing is, I'm wondering if women at particular ages, say 30, 35, had access to a test. I'm not sure if that exists. Maybe it's a HGC hormone or something like that, to say, hey, how fertile are you at this point? Or how fast is your fertility declining? Then they could maybe make a more informed decision.
Thank you, Hester, for your call. Dr. Callen.
So, you know, I think your point is a great one about really understanding that the process of fertility, you know, you might or someone might think that, well, if I wait a certain amount of time, you know, fertility treatments are out there and I can just do IUI, as you referred to, intrauterine insemination or ovulation induction or in vitro fertilization, IVF. The other term, ICSI, that you used is a way to fertilize eggs, intracytoplasmic sperm injection. But sort of this gamut of fertility treatments that are out there can be emotionally difficult and financially difficult to pursue, and they're not always successful, and they can be trying for women, trying for couples. And so I think it goes back to understanding what is happening to fertility over time and understanding that the options are out there, but the options are not always successful. Even IVF, you know, as women get into their early 40s, we quote success rates that are in the single digits for IVF, you know, after 42, 43. So to me, the worst situation is when someone comes into my office and she isn't at all aware that her fertility has declined, and maybe she's 42 or 43 and just thinking about starting a family, and no one's really ever had this conversation with her before. That to me is the most difficult situation, because then we're talking about success rates for fertility treatment that can really be quite low.
So if there's one piece of advice that you could give our listeners, is it starting in your 20s, really thinking about maybe being educated on these options and so that you have the most information as possible moving forward?
Yeah, I think being aware, being educated, understanding what happens to fertility over time, knowing that the reproductive challenges can increase, especially in the mid-30s, late 30s, early 40s, certainly. And, you know, the time to, you know, consider having a child, if you want to have a child or want to bring a child into your life, is as soon as it's right for you and not to wait longer than that. And that's such a vague sort of wishy-washy answer, I know. But the time is different for everybody, and just to be aware that those challenges can increase.
Dr. Amanda Callen is assistant professor and practicing OBGYN at the Yale Fertility Center in New Haven, Connecticut. Dr. Callen, thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Up next, how does a woman's education level impact fertility? We're going to learn more from a Harvard researcher right after the break. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. We wanted to learn more about how education correlates with fertility rates. So joining us on the phone now is Dr. Jocelyn Finlay, senior research scientist in the Department of Global Health and Population at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Dr. Finlay, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Lucy. It's a pleasure to be here.
Our time is short with the number of callers that we brought in this hour, but could you explain the relationship between education and fertility?
Yes, it's really great to hear all the callers calling in and seeing that they're juggling education decisions and their fertility, and they're really in their later life in terms of their fertility, so looking into their 30s. And I feel like this really came from research that was done from Claudia Golden, and she was able to explain that the introduction of the pill back in the 60s and 70s was really the first time that women could really reliably complete their college education without fear of getting pregnant. It just meant that women could then build their aspirations for more highly skilled professions such as doctors, lawyers, and decision makers in society. And it was the first time that they could really think about alternatives in their life course. So thinking about solid careers and as opposed to just having children and being homemakers.
Now, when you look across the globe, do you see there a causal relationship? So when girls are able to continue with schooling, that they're not having babies as young or having as many children?
Yeah, that's right. A lot of my work, being the partner of Global Health and Population, a lot of my work has been in Africa. And there we're still looking at sort of the making sure that girls are completing school and looking at teen pregnancies and making sure that we don't see those high rates of teen pregnancies, because it ends up for bad outcomes for the mother and the child. And so what we see there is that if we can get girls to stay in school, then they do choose to do that, and they're able to delay their first marriage and their first birth. And this ends up being great for the girls in terms of being able to complete their education and jump onto a trajectory of high-skilled work instead of just being in the cycle of not completing high school, getting low-skilled jobs, this ends up just sort of being their trajectory for life of this low-skilled work. And it then becomes very hard to jump from the low-skilled trajectory to the high-skilled trajectory as you keep going along.
When we look at some of the research that you've done with African countries, so the ability to continue with education limits the fertility rate, but at the same time, they need more than that. They also need support. Can you talk about the Malawi example?
So Sarah Baird did some really important research in Malawi looking at how to promote keeping girls in school and how this impacts delaying their first marriage and delaying their first birth. And she found two really important outcomes. One is that it's not just education, as in let's put the girls in school and keep them protected from the perils of society, of the adult roles of society, of marriage and childbearing. But the education really needs to be high quality. They need to have high quality education so that they can go on to get really good jobs. And also, girls can't just do it by themselves. So you can't just say to a girl, oh, okay, you go off and do your education. If you want to do it, that's great for you. It really has to be something that's supported by the community and something that becomes really valued by the community and their future partners. It's a road to empowerment, but they can't travel by themselves. They need the community to support them in that.
When we think about community support, also certain policies in place within government to support families, we know that there's a continuing discussion about paid family leave that's necessary mm-hmm. in this country, as well as that conversation is happening in states, also here in Connecticut. And in terms of when we talk about discrimination, when women become pregnant or discrimination against mothers, what are we seeing in other countries about how they are treated, or even if there's a wage gap that persists?
Yeah, I feel like there has been a lot of research on this, and Natalie talked a little bit about this earlier in the program about this gender discrimination. And I think one of the things that's really important, it's not just, you know, you can look after your baby for 3 months or 1 month and then return to work and everything is exactly like it was before. And I think some research has been shown that it's not always necessarily a gender discrimination story, but it's the fact that women now have dependents and it doesn't make them as flexible in their workforce participation as what they were before they had the baby. And so, you know, being able to work overtime a few nights a week, or, you know, suddenly something random comes up at work and you need to work on it until midnight. Women with dependents just aren't going to be able to do that with flexibility. If they need to go home and relieve the nanny or pick the kids up from daycare. Mm. And so I think the research advanced a little bit from just thinking about gender discrimination to seeing, well, what is the nature of the job and how can women juggle that in their lives and have dependents be able to keep their job.
Are we seeing a change in this idea of default parent, if you could describe what that is?
Yeah, I feel like in families where there is pressure, you have to, and we've heard from families about the financial pressure of raising children, and so definitely need to work, and often having the dual income is needed to be able to raise a family. But within the family unit, you're going to have to make decisions about, well, who's going to be the frontline parent? Who's going to be the one dropping off every day or picking up every day? Who's going to be the one who sacrifices their job if one of the children gets sick? And I think this often falls to the woman. So it's either because of just the natural historical gender role assignment, or it could be that the person in the couple who earns the most, you decide, well, let's protect their career, and the other person in the couple will be the one who is the default parent, who the one is that always gets to sacrifice their job hours.
Dr. Jocelyn Finlay is senior research scientist in the Department of Global Health and Population at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. She studies the sociology of fertility and looks at how education and career choices interact when people decide to start a family. Dr. Finlay, thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it. We'll send a link out for more about this research.
Great. Thank you, Lucy.
And you can find that at Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Today's show produced by Carmen Baskoff. Special thanks to Jason, our intern, and Jason Perez, I should say, and our technical producer, Kion Wolf. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Thanks for listening.